Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Hey guys, Carrie here with another episode of Artrageous. I'm so excited for today's episode. It's a great story of a marketing mishap that almost cost a really big corporation a lot of money, which is kind of fun in and of itself, but I'm even more excited that today we have our first ever guest. Nate from Mysteries of the Ohio Valley and owner of Stoveleg Media is joining me today to talk about this crazy story, and I can't wait to get into it. But first, Nate, say hi and tell the audience a little bit more about you.
Hello, Artrageous fan base. I'm so excited for this show. As Carrie said, yep, president of Stoveleg Media, owner of Stoveleg Media, whatever you want to call it. I was really excited when Carrie told me about this idea for the show, and her being a graphic designer, I knew that she would have awesome podcast art, and she does. And when she asked me to be a part of it and actually hop on an episode, I just couldn't say no. And we've got a good story today, I think, Carrie. So let's not waste any time talking about little old me. Let's get into this.
So getting into today's story, we will be taking a fun trip back to the mid-1990s, when ad campaigns were still fun and the cola wars were at their height. Coca-Cola had always been the leader since its inception and was naturally the biggest cola company. But this wouldn't be corporate America without an underdog wanting a share of the market. I hope you can guess who, but just in case, I'll spoil the non-surprise and say that our underdog in this story is none other than the blue to Coke's red, the sugar to Coke's cocaine, it's Pepsi. Marketing really can be a dog-eat-dog world, but lucky for Pepsi, their strongest weapon was their advertising, and they came up with some really fantastic commercials. I think the celebrity endorsements also helped, so let me help Pepsi name drop here. They had Michael Jackson, who did a commercial where he re-recorded his song Billie Jean with lyrics specifically for Pepsi. I think Shaq was in one, and a lot of people still remember the Cindy Crawford 1992 Super Bowl commercial, considering people still dress up in a white tank top and jean shorts for Halloween. Maybe it's because it's an easy last-minute costume. Maybe it's because it's iconic. Nate and I can debate that in some outtakes from the show. But here's the thing about ad campaigns, especially in mainstream media. You always have to be creating the next best thing. As a designer, creative director, art director, ad agency, whatever, you always have to be pushing and creating new and better things. The pressure can be a lot. I know even I sometimes feel it when working in the insurance industry. I mean, what beats Flow or a CGI gecko? Well, a lot actually, but that's a whole other episode. Marketing in the 90s ran into the same problem. I would actually argue that the 90s had some of the best commercials ever created. Nate, we grew up in the 90s. Are there any commercials that you can remember that still stick with you?
So I had to go back, and I've done it many a times, to watch some of the toy commercials that were really pointed toward kids like you and I that were growing up in the early mid-90s. And one that really sticks out to me is a commercial for, I think it was Hasbro or Mattel or one of these play companies. It was called Mr. Bucket, and it is the most absurd commercial when you watch it today. It's got this goofy little voice, haha, I'm Mr. Bucket, hello, put your balls in my top, and all this stuff. It is a very strange commercial. But as a kid, you know, it was very colorful, it was catchy, it was fun, and I mean, it's Mr. Bucket. Buckets of fun, right? Everyone remembers that if you were a kid back then, and that's just one example. Coca-Cola and Pepsi have had so many great commercials in the past, like you were alluding to, and I will say also, I personally am a Pepsi guy over Coke always, but I don't really know why I am a Pepsi and Coke guy. We can get into more of that as this show goes on, but yeah, definitely some fun commercials from back in the 90s.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about that weird, fun voice with like, ooh, like kind of voice. Yeah. And then you get like the oink, oink, Zoo Pals.
Oh, Zoo Pals.
Yeah. So that's what I was thinking. It was like the Zoo Pals plates.
I might have told you about Yipe Stripes gum. I know you weren't a big Yipe Stripes girl.
But, no, I didn't like gum until like 7th grade.
Yeah, yeah. And my mom didn't really want us chewing a lot of gum, especially in the house, because, you know, getting it in the carpet, and it'd probably be a mess to clean with little runts like me and my brother. But lots of good ones for sure.
For sure. So getting back into the story, we can see that same level of aspiring to excite viewers. And at the same time, Pepsi was contracted with one of the largest advertising agencies in the world. The chief operations officer and the creative director of the marketing firm BBDO were working with the chief marketing officer of Pepsi, and they were trying to come up with a television ad campaign for the new Pepsi points promotion.
The idea behind the promotion was fairly simple. You buy Pepsi, you collect Pepsi points, and you redeem the points to get stuff. Their tagline was literally, drink Pepsi, get stuff. They tailored the prizes to the younger generation, the Pepsi generation as they called it. and included items like t-shirts, sunglasses, leather jackets, things like that. All things that you would consider maybe cool back in the 90s. To win the Cola Wars, Pepsi had to not only outsell Coke in the marketplace, but they had to become integrated into the very fabric of society. Coke had the polar bears, which grandma might think are cute and all, but Pepsi wanted more. They wanted to be next. They wanted to be known as the cool, hip brand that everyone wanted. Pepsi was totally focused in targeting the younger generation that would grow up with the fizzy beverage and drink it for years to come. Another example, as far as me growing up and remembering Pepsi, I was a big NASCAR fan as a kid. Jeff Gordon, the young, fun 90s race car driver, he wasn't a Coke guy. He was always the Pepsi-sponsored driver. And people that were Earnhardt fans hated him because he's the young kid from California. But Pepsi was fun, and Pepsi kind of embodied that, not just in their advertisements, but also in where they went for sponsorships for even sports teams and race car drivers. That's kind of cool. But let's get into more of how they accomplished finding that niche and attacking that younger audience.
I think that was the question that the marketing guys were trying to figure out. Like, they needed to come up with something that would get people's attention. It had to make people laugh, and it had to get people interested and remember the Pepsi Points program. So Pepsi went all in and took every marketing dollar they had for the summer of 1995 and put it behind a commercial. And in the words of Pepsi's former creative director, Michael Patti, that's when hit the fan. So Nate, let's talk about this commercial. We'll put a link to the YouTube video in the show notes down below, but give me a brief rundown of the commercial.
The narrative of the commercial was pretty straightforward. It started with a kid who was late to school. He put on his Pepsi t-shirt, and across the bottom of the screen flashed the caption, t-shirt, 80 Pepsi points. The kid walked down the hallway and put on his Pepsi leather jacket, and he got that out for 1,200 Pepsi points, and then walked out the front door and put on his Pepsi sunglasses that could be purchased for only 125 Pepsi points. The screen then cuts to the school where there's some kids sitting on the curb looking at a Pepsi Points catalog. The wind picks up and the screen cuts to a classroom where papers are flying everywhere. Next thing you know, the kid from the beginning of the commercial drops out of the sky in a Harrier jet, and the caption simply read, Harrier Fighter, 7 million Pepsi points. The commercial ends simply with a tagline, drink Pepsi, get stuff.
All around, a cute, fun, almost simple commercial with a little tongue-in-cheek marketing that does a really great job of getting the message across. Drink Pepsi, get stuff. The subtext here being, drink Pepsi, be cool. Now, this was a national commercial. It ran across the U.S., and it was only a matter of time until someone found a flaw in the commercial's marketing. In the summer of 1995, John Leonard, a 21-year-old business student, saw the commercial for the first time.
And maybe other people are different, but when you're at that age, at least for me, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to get out of life. I was trying to really not even think of that. I was just having fun in college at that point. But I think he saw the commercial and truly saw it as a real opportunity, because upon doing some research and crunching the numbers, he realized that a Harrier jet, which is a big, you know, military style jet, could cost somewhere that's like $32 million. So you could probably get 7 million Pepsi points for a lot less than 32 million bucks.
All right, Nate, as a former accountant and numbers guy yourself, is it safe to say that the number crunching took him down a bit of a rabbit hole?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I know former accountant, that was what I did before Stoveleg Media full-time, but now that I'm running Stoveleg Media, there's a lot of accounting that goes into it too. So I don't quite get away from those number crunching days, but I definitely can see him or can see anyone going down that rabbit hole and seeing kind of a cost analysis chart saying, how many Pepsi products would I have to purchase in order to hit that break-even point and then qualify for this 7 million point Harrier? And Leonard saw the opportunity. When he ran the numbers, he saw a very legitimate way to get those 7 million points. But since it was a national commercial, Leonard had no idea how many people were trying to do the exact same thing. So there was a sense of urgency, and of course he wanted to do it as cheap as possible. He's 21 years old. He doesn't have all of the money in the world just to go buy a bunch of Pepsi and accumulate those 7 million points. He started with buying a ton of 12 packs of Pepsi, but within about the first week, Leonard and his family realized that there was no way that they could drink that much Pepsi. After running into that roadblock, he realized he needed to switch strategy.
It sounds like it was time to use the phone-a-friend option. Leonard had met a man named Todd Hoffman about a year or so earlier while working as a junior climbing guide and climbing Mount Denali in Alaska. Being on a high-altitude mountain in freezing cold Alaska, you can imagine that you might get stuck at a couple points waiting for weather to pass. And that's really where John Leonard and Tom Hoffman bonded. Hoffman was a businessman in his early 40s that had been successful in multiple ventures like publishing, real estate, and a couple other things. Leonard was a business student, so naturally he really looked up to Hoffman. When it was time for Leonard to climb the metaphorical mountain of obtaining enough Pepsi points to win a Harrier jet, Leonard knew he could count on Hoffman for guidance.
Could you imagine what Hoffman thought when this 21-year-old kid came to him with this crazy idea?
I mean, he probably had a great deal of skepticism, but Leonard probably showed him the commercial enough times that eventually he made a pretty good case. Hoffman was amazed at what he was, or rather wasn't, seeing. It's the commercial itself that's really what's at the root of this whole marketing fiasco. Because as Hoffman noticed, there was no disclaimer. There was no caption or legal blurbage to indicate that the offer of a Harrier jet was a joke or not legitimate. Hoffman couldn't believe it. How could a multi-million dollar corporation make such a huge oversight? Well, I guess they thought it was to their advantage because Hoffman asked Leonard to come up with a formal business plan and present it to him. If you're a designer or a tech nerd in any capacity, I think we can get a good giggle out of the fact that John Leonard was using WordPerfect to create this business proposal. I personally don't remember days before Microsoft Word on a box of a gateway computer when I was a kid, but some of our audience might remember the days before Apple and Adobe took a majority stockhold of our souls. Numbers guy, what did this business plan look like?
Well, the numbers are actually quite interesting. Leonard had to account for things like labor costs, transportation costs, and storage costs. He needed people to go buy the Pepsi and move it somewhere, and then he needed somewhere to put it all. The math broke down to something like this. One 12-pack of Pepsi awarded 5 points. At 5 points per 12-pack, you would need 1.4 million packs to reach 7 million points. That's over 16 million cans of Pepsi. If you're looking to store that much and you calculate the volume, you would need about 600,000 cubic square feet of storage space. Leonard calculated that he could get 6 storage facilities in 6 different metropolitan areas with about 45 workers to buy the Pepsi, transport it, and cut off the points. When it was all said and done, it was a multi-million dollar business deal to acquire all of the points needed. $4.3 million is what it would cost, to be exact.
That's a lot of money, and of course Hoffman had questions.
You mean he wouldn't just sign a check for $4.3 million to a 21-year-old kid?
I think you might have to ask me when I actually have $4.3 million to spare, but I'm going to go with no.
We keep, you know, pushing this show a little bit. Maybe there will be $4.3 million. You never know. These advertisement breaks really bring it in for you, so.
I think we're going to have to wait until about, like, episode 5 or 6 before that starts happening.
That's fair. That's fair.
And I think Hoffman shared the same sentiment because when he asked questions like, is owning a Harrier jet even legal? Which it turns out it is if you take off all the guns and missiles and radar jamming equipment. He also asked what Leonard wanted to do with the jet, which honestly is a super valid point. But Leonard had a good answer too, with a plan to make money off of it from air shows plus advertising and movie deals. The one question that he couldn't answer though was, what if they didn't get the points in time? If they didn't succeed in this crazy plan, they would be out $4.3 million, and I'm pretty sure there's not a huge market for secondhand Pepsi cans.
So, what did Leonard do? Because obviously the story does not end here.
Well, he went home and stewed on it for a while. I mean, it sucked to have someone poke holes in this metaphorical balloon and see his vision come crashing down like the fiery Hindenburg. But somewhere along the line, John Leonard went into a convenience store and saw one of the in-store displays for the Pepsi points promotion. When he picked up the catalog, he found something intriguing in the fine print. According to the official promotion rules, you could buy Pepsi points for 10 cents apiece.
That doesn't take me too long to crunch the numbers that 10 cents per Pepsi point basically means that you need $700,000 to buy a $32 million Harrier jet. 700K sounds a whole lot more doable than that $4.3 million, but beyond that, the workers, the storage facilities, ridiculous amounts of cola.
Yeah, and with that discovery, all of the hurdles had just evaporated. Leonard called Hoffman incessantly until he got a hold of him. Once he read the fine print, Hoffman agreed to write this check. Now, naturally, there wasn't a checkbox for Harrier jet on the claim form, so Leonard created a box for it and basically wrote it into the form and included an extra $8.50 for shipping.
Now, I know things are more expensive to ship now than they did back then, but how much does a Harrier jet actually weigh?
Now, we don't have a fact checker in our production budget, so I'm really not sure.
Still, $8.50 sounds like a pretty good steal when it comes to shipping costs.
I'm pretty sure it would cost more than $8.50 to ship a potato, but if they could really get the jet, I'd say it was well worth it.
Were they really crazy enough to put a check for $700,000 in change in the mail?
I don't think they trusted the United States Postal Service enough for that one, because when Hoffman wrote the check, Leonard flew from Seattle to Hoffman's home in Miami, and then Hoffman sent the check in a paralegal with Leonard to personally drop off the check in the P.O. box in Young America, Minnesota. What was hilarious is that Leonard and the paralegal got into town on Friday, stayed a night in a hotel, and then drove to drop the check off on Saturday. But I guess among all of the excitement, they totally forgot that the post office was closed on Saturdays.
After all that planning, after all of those number crunching nights, are you kidding me?
I mean, I guess that if I was trying to get a Harrier jet and I finally had a path to it, I could see how it would happen, you know? It's just you get so excited and then you go and you're here, but the post office is closed. But luckily, there was someone in the back that let them in for a second to drop the envelope in the box.
And then?
A whole lot of nothing. Leonard didn't hear anything at all from Pepsi for a long time. But I think that's because Pepsi just didn't know how to respond. When they got the check, the chief marketing officer of Pepsi called up the COO of the ad agency and basically said, "Hey, someone just sent us a check for $700K for the jet." The ad agency guys thought it was a joke, and when they realized it wasn't, they had to get some in-house counsel involved. If it was some kind of money grab situation, they didn't want other people to get the same idea.
I guess if you're an ad agency trying to help Pepsi win the Cola Wars, you don't want to get too distracted by legal technicalities.
No, you really don't. The ad agency thought it would be at least funny to keep the check and just send John Leonard the model they used in the commercial. But Pepsi finally responded to Leonard in May of 1996 with a letter in the mail that read, "Thanks for the effort. Ha ha ha. It was meant to be a joke. For your troubles, here's your coupons for two cases of Pepsi." And then just to be extra nice, they included the original $700,000 check.
Wow, two cases? That's it? That's like a $10 value.
I would be furious for like a day, maybe a week.
But Leonard and Hoffman were in it to win it, so they decided to press the issue and hired a lawyer that helped them send a letter back to Pepsi. Something to the effect of, you made an offer, that offer was accepted, you have to deliver on that offer. Even the lawyer agreed that, in their eyes, they had met all the requirements of the promotion. Pepsi clearly had enough money to afford a Harrier jet, so they needed to make good on that offer. Now, you're talking about poking a serious bear here. Not the Coca-Cola bear, but still, Pepsi is a big, big company, not someone that you want to mess around with.
Pepsi realized that this could actually be an issue, so they got their lawyers involved and somehow managed to sue Leonard. Of course, Leonard sued them back, and if you've gone this far, you can't back down now. They had to set the stage that they meant business, even if it meant that they had to go up against the big-time corporate lawyers for Pepsi, the ad agency, and even insurance company lawyers.
One sec. If Pepsi has all of these big lawyers, how did something like this even happen in the first place? Were they not doing their job?
Well, this is where we get into the design portion of the story that I find so fascinating because I can relate to it. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Pepsi commercial in this story that was just plain crazy.
Was that a pun?
Maybe. More when we come back. Let's get back into the fun design portion of this episode, where we talk about marketing strategy and the crucial decisions that were made during the creative process. I mentioned earlier that there was a lot of pressure put on ad agencies to come up with the latest and greatest marketing campaigns. Pepsi's ad agency, BBDO, was one of the first prominent ad agencies in the world, so they were in the same pressure cooker as everyone else. The creative director for the Pepsi campaign, Michael Patti, had been working on Pepsi commercials for 20 years at the time of the 1995 campaign. So Patti and his creative partner, Don Schneider, did what a lot of creatives do and basically locked themselves in a room until they came up with some kind of idea or direction for this campaign. They needed to come up with something that showed off the Pepsi points catalog and the campaign, but they couldn't simply put that on TV and call it a day. They needed to figure out how to make the catalog and campaign exciting, and they decided they needed some kind of surprise ending that would be funny. Ultimately, they came up with a version of the commercial that Leonard and everyone saw on TV, but there were a few key differences between the original storyboards and the final commercial. First off, since they were going for a very tongue-in-cheek marketing strategy, they wanted the kid in the commercial to be a kid with personality. Nate, did you ever watch The Sandlot when growing up?
I did, many times over. Any 90s kid definitely is familiar with the movie, but I am probably, and as a former college baseball player, I still don't really care for The Sandlot. When it comes to those like kids movies about baseball, The Sandlot for me is actually pretty far down on the list. It's okay, but for the hype that everyone puts around it, I know that I am probably the only person who thinks this, but The Sandlot just doesn't quite do it for me. It's okay, not great.
Oh my goodness, Nate, this is blasphemy. We're going to have to talk about this later because I grew up with that movie in summer camp and it is just stuck with me throughout all these years. But if you had to choose a character in The Sandlot, who was your favorite?
Well, I mean, Benny the Jet Rodriguez, got to go with him. And I really, as a kid, oh man, I loved Wendy Peppercorn. But the dog too. What was was it Hercules?
I think it was Hercules.
It was Hercules, and James Earl Jones plays the man on the other side of the fence. Then they have to get their ball back and whatever. Hamilton, of course, is fine. I just, the whole movie, I feel like people build it up as the greatest kid sports movie of all time. But personally, I'm more of like a little Big League, Rookie of the Year. Those two are the two that really stick out to me. But I don't know. That's just me. Again, heavy minority, I'm sure that I am in, but those are my opinions on The Sandlot, now that I've totally derailed this conversation.
All right, well, I'll have the audience know that I am heavily rolling my eyes at you for your opinions on The Sandlot, but I guess the marketing team for Pepsi remembered Hamilton, and that's kind of what they were modeling their main character off of for the Pepsi commercial. They wanted the kid that flew the jet to be a character with personality, someone relatable who was an underdog, a good guy, maybe a little chunky. If he wasn't going to get the cheerleaders, then at least he would get the Harrier jet.
But that's not the kid who was actually in the commercial.
No, unfortunately not. I'm sure we have one or two designers listening that can relate to the creative process. When Patty took the initial storyboard to Pepsi, they pushed back and wanted to change the main character to the cool kid and give the commercial some major Top Gun vibes.
Well, if that was the only thing that changed, that doesn't sound to me, at least, like it would be a big legal issue.
No, unfortunately, that wasn't the issue. The issue lied in the ending of the commercial with the caption for the Harrier jet. Michael Patty's original storyboard had the caption written as Harrier jet, 700 million Pepsi points. Which, when you actually look at it, that's a lot of zeros, and it's pretty funny because it's just an absolutely ridiculous number. But if you noticed, that's not the number that appeared in the commercial we've been talking about. When the original cut of the commercial was brought to the editing house, the commercial had the 700 million Pepsi points in the advertisement. But one of the clients said that the number was too hard to read. The longer the number, the smaller it is on the screen, and the number needs to fit in the frame, which back then was more square and had less screen real estate. So they had the editor take out a zero and make it 70 million. They thought it was still too hard to read, so they took out another zero. When they could more easily read 7 million, they opted to go with that.
To this day, Michael Patty will say that it was not the creative agency's fault that this situation happened. Here's what Patty had to say about it in the Netflix documentary, Pepsi, Where's My Jet?
I think they should have known better. It was their promotion. It went through their legal system. There's words in here that were written by lawyers to make sure everything was kosher and straight up.
It was just an aesthetic thing.
I gave it a minor pushback. You don't have to read that it's exactly 700 million. You just have to see there's a seven with a lot of zeros behind it to know that it is impossible and funny.
Patty gave the pushback, but ultimately he gave up and just said, okay, it's not as funny. It's just like the kid wasn't as funny. As a designer, that's one of the most difficult things about the creative process. You have this really great idea and you get so attached to it, but you have to take feedback from others. And sometimes that input modifies the thing you fell in love with. That's something that you get used to as a designer, and it's not always terrible. But in this case, Patty was a little disappointed because it made the commercial just less funny. At the end of the day, he was up against corporate, and at least the overall essence of the commercial was still intact, so he just went with it.
And they just forgot about the whole 10 cents a point thing.
I mean, honestly, sitting here talking with you about it, I almost even forgot about the 10 cents a point thing. But you would think someone somewhere in a company as large as Pepsi would have caught it. But I guess in a speed-to-market scenario, I could see how it would happen. To me, one of the biggest oversights is that the commercial didn't even have a disclaimer of any kind. Corporate legal teams are very careful about that kind of thing.
And what's also crazy about that, while all of these legal proceedings were happening, Pepsi changed the commercial multiple times. The first change was to the caption, so it read, Harrier Jet, 700 million Pepsi points. To make it more restrictive to people attempting to buy the points to claim the jet just like Leonard did. The second edit dumbed down the joke even further and featured the words, "just kidding," in parentheses below the caption. Now, many people view this as Pepsi kind of covering their butts and indirectly admitting guilt.
Okay, so we have a commercial that had no disclaimer and a Harrier jet listed for a relatively attainable amount of points. We also have John Leonard, who sent a check to Pepsi in the amount of $700,000 and some change to claim the jet. We have a cola company that said, haha, good try, it was a joke. And now we have Pepsi and Leonard suing each other.
What else could possibly go wrong?
Well, I guess you could say that this couldn't have been any more of a Harrier situation.
Another pun?
Yeah, there's a pun in the show name, so would you expect any less?
I wouldn't. I really wouldn't. I don't know what I was expecting when I sat down to do this, but you should have put a disclaimer, actually, in my contract that said, puns are included in this podcast.
Well, you still got a little bit of time to edit in some for yourself. Anyway, at this point, it's late 1996, and you have some really big corporate law professionals going up against the little guys. How do you think this goes?
Sounds to me like settling is a good option, probably for both parties, because you don't want to walk away from this empty-handed if you're on either side. If you're Pepsi, obviously you don't want to be giving up a whole Harrier jet. If you're, you know, the party that's suing Pepsi, actually, and you think that you actually have a case, something is always better than nothing.
You would think, right? Well, Pepsi's lawyers and Leonard Hoffman and their lawyers all got together around a table sometime in 1996 to try to settle the dispute out of the courts. Pepsi came in with an attitude of, okay, so what do you really want? They didn't like the joke too much when Leonard insisted on the jet, so in true movie fashion, they wrote a number down on a piece of paper and basically slid it across the table to Leonard. They had offered to settle for $750,000 and could go up to $1 million. Remember, Pepsi was not number one in the Cola Wars yet, so they were hoping to get out of this debacle with as little publicity as possible. But John Leonard wanted what was seemingly fair. If the jet was worth $32 million, then $1 million was a drop in the bucket. His friend and business partner Hoffman would support Leonard no matter what he decided to do. This was Leonard's deal. I think a lot of people would have just taken the cash and left it at that, but Leonard insisted on the jet. To him, it wasn't for the money. He had nothing to lose, and he wanted the jet.
Up until then, things were exciting, but not really crazy, and this is where things kind of start going off the rails. Leonard and Hoffman realized that if they were going to go up against Pepsi, they needed a lawyer who was more than equipped to handle the job. In the summer of 1997, 2 years after Leonard first saw the Pepsi commercial, Leonard and Hoffman brought Michael Avenatti on board. Now, you may recognize the name because he was all over the news. He was the lawyer for, like, Stormy Daniels just a couple of years before this podcast was released. He was on the news all the time, 60 Minutes, CNN, you name it, talk shows left and right. He also was convicted of trying to extort up to $25 million from Nike and currently has 36 federal indictments. Kind of a greaseball. Avenatti was only 26, but while not exactly a full lawyer yet, he had an entire career of political opposition research and media relations while attending law school at night. Even as a law student, Avenatti realized that they were highly unlikely to win the case in a court of law. There had been some strategic litigation mistakes, such as allowing Pepsi to sue John Leonard first in the state of New York, where Pepsi knew they would be in an advantage because the Southern District Courts were more friendly to corporations in such cases.
Avenatti wanted to bring the fight to Pepsi, and what better way than in the court of public opinion? With the help of Avenatti, Leonard's case was brought to public attention with the help of local TV and radio stations. Leonard received dozens of interview requests from television networks like Extra, the CBS Morning Show, Burden of Proof, and Dan Rather. The goal was to convince people that Pepsi, in the interest of profits, were disregarding people like John Leonard. And of course, Pepsi didn't just sit back and take the heat. They're a huge corporation with tons of connections and power. One example is when Leonard went through the process of getting onto the David Letterman show. The interview seemed like a done deal. But at the last minute, a producer called Letterman and said that the interview was off. Pepsi was one of their biggest sponsors.
Now, as someone whose entire income is based off of the media and corporations and sponsorships, that's what I do between voiceovers and podcasting and stuff, I kind of get it. I know how the media kind of works with this, and the attention died down really, really quickly. When the story grew cold and the media moved on, Leonard, Hoffman, and Avenatti were left to play the waiting game. Leonard went back to Seattle, Hoffman did his thing, and occasionally the two would talk on the phone from time to time to keep the ball rolling on the legal side, but not a lot was happening. But Avenatti, being a very aggressive individual, wanted the ball to do more than roll. I'm sure he was seeing big dollar signs in his future if they were able to win. He wanted it all to come crashing down on the head of Pepsi and continued to build Leonard's case. So he did what he was best at, opposition research. Now keep in mind, this was back in the days before the internet was super widely available, so the things that Avenatti dug up were not widely known to the public. 4 years before the Harrier Jet ad, Pepsi had run a similar promotion in the Philippines called Pepsi Number Fever, in an attempt to usurp Coca-Cola's 75% market share in the country. Pepsi's promotion offered a tantalizing prize of 1 million pesos to the winner of the promotion. Now, there was a lot of poverty in the Philippines, so 1 million pesos could really change people's lives. And the people of the Philippines tried very hard to win. All they had to do was buy Pepsi and collect bottle caps. If the three numbers on the cap matched the winning number given out by Pepsi, they won the prize.
But what happens if there's multiple winners? When the winning number of 349 was announced, people soon realized that there wasn't just one winner, but many. Thousands of people had just won the lottery. When Pepsi realized their mistake, they claimed there was a technical computer error and they would not pay out the winners. People rushed to the Pepsi offices demanding that Pepsi honor the promotion. Rocks were being thrown at Pepsi salesmen. Molotov cocktails were being thrown at Pepsi trucks. The riots were deadly. It was even more of a disaster than the Harrier jet.
I personally did not know that before reading into this story. So very amazing stuff. And I'm sure there are plenty of listeners out there that are just as shocked as I am. And I'm even a Pepsi shareholder for that matter. But anyways, after digging up this bombshell, Avenatti came to the conclusion that Pepsi had a history of making promises and just flat not delivering.
And in the true Avenatti form, he wanted to punch back at Pepsi to sway public opinion in his client's favor. Ironically, like the marketing team that originally created the commercial, Avenatti needed to create an ad campaign that was memorable. One of the ads took a literal direct punch at Pepsi and was a portrait of a guy with a Pepsi logo for a black eye with the caption, "Pepsi, deceiving a generation." One ad was a full blank white page with a small disclaimer at the bottom reading, "Hey Pepsi, look down here. This is a space that's reserved for legal verbiage." You know, the kind of stuff that keeps you from getting in trouble. A third ad had a Pepsi bottle as a Molotov cocktail in direct reference to the failed marketing campaign in the Philippines. Avenatti literally held zero punches with these ads. I'll admit, they were pretty clever, but do you really want to stoop that low in a big legal battle?
Now, I don't think so, but this is Avenatti we're talking about. Michael Avenatti don't mess around when it comes to, you know, bringing down the house, or at least attempting to bring down the house in the most boisterous way possible. But the likelihood of Pepsi suing over the ads was guaranteed, 100%. They were going to fight back, and they were probably going to win. And Leonard and Hoffman saw that, and they erred on the side of caution because these ads never actually were published, and the legal battle just trudged on, and things moved slower than ever.
There were a couple things that Leonard and his friends were hoping for in this legal battle. Unfortunately for Leonard, the case was assigned to Judge Kimba Wood, a federal district court judge who tended to be in favor of corporations and come out on the side of big business.
Without a sympathetic judge, Leonard was hoping to get in front of a jury of peers, figuring that if they could appeal to like-minded individuals, they would have a better chance at winning the case. A jury of ordinary people would have a better reflection of society than the background of a highly educated and very biased Judge Wood. But Pepsi's power is very far-reaching and was able to convince Judge Wood to grant a summary judgment, which is a legal mechanism that's used to decide a case before it gets to jury. So Pepsi, their legal people are no slouches. They know what's going on, and they knew the strategy that Leonard and company was going to try to put into play.
And I think that's the reason that they decided to sue Leonard first was so that they could get this court in New York. Okay, so no to a sympathetic judge, no to a jury. Maybe depositions would help Leonard's case. After all, questioning people from BBDO who actually worked on the commercial would allow for answers that the quote-unquote evidence couldn't answer on its own. But Judge Wood was not swayed. In her view, all of the relevant facts were already there. The commercial itself, the Pepsi points catalog, and the correspondence between Leonard and Pepsi. So add depositions to the list of no's too.
Things were not looking good for John Leonard's case, and the outcome reflected that. Ultimately, in a pretty lengthy opinion for a rather straightforward contracts case, Judge Wood determined that the case did not have merit. She deemed that the offer wouldn't have been seen as reasonable by a reasonable person as a legitimate offer.
That's kind of an anticlimactic ending to this whole thing, don't you think? No Harrier jet was awarded and no money came out of it.
Yes, but one thing did come out of it, though.
Okay, you're right. In a very ironic twist of fate, the former COO of Pepsi's ad agency, Jeff Mordos, one day got a call from his son, who was in law school, and he asked, "Hey, Dad, do you know anything about a Harrier jet?"
Which is so perfect.
Oh, yeah. The Leonard versus PepsiCo case is now a critical case study in law books for understanding the boundaries of contract law.
Which is totally, totally wild. Carrie, give me your opinion. Should Leonard have gotten the jet, yes or no?
I mean, I have no idea what he would have done with this jet, but, you know, I think he should have. Even though the jet wasn't listed in the Pepsi Points catalog, there wasn't a disclaimer in the commercial saying that the jet wasn't a legitimate prize. Combine that with the way Pepsi changed the advertisement after the fact, I think there's a lot going wrong on Pepsi's side. What do you think?
Now, I personally feel kind of harsh against, you know, Judge Wood, and I thought it was, you know, kind of shady that they're taking their case to New York, where big businesses can thrive, and they have a much more unfair playing ground and definitely an advantage on the side of Pepsi. But I think two things. One, I don't disagree with the judge that any reasonable individual would not think that they could just get a Harrier jet for $700,000. I think that two things could have taken place that would have made this at least a little more fair in my eyes. One, that Pepsi, who had the idea at the very beginning to just send him or give him the Harrier model that they used, I would say that would be fair because in the commercial, they used a model. They didn't actually use a real Harrier jet that's $32 million. Given the model, maybe not for $700,000, but at cost, I would say, whatever the model cost, which I don't think would have been $700,000, but probably, I don't know, $100,000, I could definitely see a real model costing back then. And I think that would have solved it. Everyone goes home happy, maybe not happy, but at least, you know, Pepsi's not totally out, and neither is Leonard. Leonard at least has this nice trophy that he can talk and brag to his friends about. However, I do think that I wish that there would have been some sort of settlement. I feel like that would have also been fair, not for the full $32 million. I do think that it's a little extravagant, and when you get Michael Avenatti involved, you're not making any friends when you're getting Michael Avenatti involved. And I know he's got a lot of legal trouble right now in the year 2023, and things aren't easy for him. He did make this a bigger case, and I guess we're going to be talking about it on podcasts, and law students are going to be reading about it in their books for years to come, but I actually am going to kind of lean on Pepsi's side here. It seems ridiculous. And beyond that, it seems like a waste of taxpayer money for the legal system to just drone on and on and on, continuing to pay judges and pay other people. It just seemed a little too extravagant for my taste. But then again, that's New York, that's Pepsi, that's everything. That they wanted to be big, and unfortunately, they kind of got caught getting a little too aggressive in their design, in their commercial, in their advertisement.
I'm just going to have to clap back at you real quick on this whole marketing side. You know, I really don't think that it was the marketing team's fault.
Of Pepsi, you mean? Yeah. Or do you mean the creative agency beforehand?
The creative agency beforehand.
You think that it is not their fault?
No, I'm going to go with Michael Patti on this one. The guy that worked for BBDO, he was the creative director for the Pepsi ad campaign. You know, he originally had that 700 million Pepsi points in there. That was part of his creative vision. That was part of what made the commercial funny. And then you go through all of the editing processes, and it was the Pepsi editors that took it down to 7 million points and then completely forgot about the 10 cents a point thing. So this is not on the marketing agency. This is on Pepsi itself.
I could agree at least that Pepsi did dig this hole, and that if you were going to sue someone, you would sue Pepsi, which works out great because I would think, and I would need to look at the numbers, but I would think that Pepsi would have the deepest pockets compared to even a high-end marketing agency like BBDO. I gotta think Pepsi would be the bigger company that you could sue for more money, which obviously they did. They weren't even suing necessarily for money. They were suing for a big Harrier jet, of course, with the gun stripped and all of that.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, Leonard probably should have taken the $750 or $1 million when it was offered for the settlement. You know, you can always look back and say, like, ah, shoulda, woulda, coulda. But at the end of the day, you know, I think it's just a really fun story. And I find it hilarious that even so many years later, you have kids of these people that were involved coming back and being like, hey, this is in law books now. Like, I think that's just a really ironic twist of fate. And while really nothing came out of it, it's just a really fun story.
Settling, always the best option, people. Get it out of court. Take care of it on your own. I mean, and even if you are really, really right, you feel truly like you've got the case, the legal system is very, very strange, and it's different in every country. It's different in every state, even here in the United States. And I think this is a good example of that on this episode of Artrageous.
Well, everyone, that's the story of Pepsi's plane problem and an almost marketing disaster. This is one of our longer episodes, so I appreciate you hanging in there with us. If you want more on this story, Pepsi Where's My Jet is now streaming on Netflix in a four-part documentary that also answers the age-old question of which is better, Coke or Pepsi. Side note, Nate, the answer is Coke. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If so, please leave me a five-star review so I can continue to bring you stories that you're interested in. Nate, thank you so much for joining me today. You can find more of Nate on his podcast, Mysteries of the Ohio Valley. We might even get lucky, and maybe he'll join us again sometime for another episode where we can wing it on some of the commentary.
Yes, I would greatly enjoy that down the road. I know this is the very beginning of this show in Artrageous, but obviously you're doing the work as far as putting the all of the information in there. Obviously, you've got the equipment. The podcast sounds great, and it's just a matter of growing and getting the name out there. And maybe we can call Michael Avenatti, and we can have him do some opposition research on other podcasts. Okay, maybe not. Maybe that's not the best way to grow the show. But yes, five-star reviews would be awesome, Carrie. Make sure that everyone out there listening, if you do listen to this show and you want more people to listen to it, great way to do it. It costs you nothing. Just tap that little five-star button, whether it's Spotify, whether it's Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your shows, make sure that you support Artrageous. And yeah, you can come on over to Mysteries of the Ohio Valley, too. Stoveleg has a lot of really great shows, and I know I'm biased, obviously, but True Crime Cast is on there. Bless Their Hearts. All of these shows are made in the heartland of the United States, but I think that it speaks to a global audience, and I think a story like this fits perfectly with that igniting conversation style that we like to put on all of our content. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to Artrageous. And I don't know, how do you close the show out?
Well, first, I want to remind you guys that next week we're going to get back into some mystery in the art world. You probably know the name, but none of us know the face, and you won't want to miss it. And I close it by saying, until then, stay Artrageous.
Love it.
Series music created by Arenson. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Artrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.